Coming up on Tech News Weekly, the Valve Index may be the next thing in VR. Twitter is getting serious about battling extremism. The secret life of the bedside iPhone, tracking bar ruffians with patron scan, and how Google employs more contractors than full-time employees. Is that right? That's up next on Tech News Weekly.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
This is Tech News Weekly, episode 85, recorded Thursday, May 30th, 2019. This episode of Tech News Weekly is brought to you by Envoy. Envoy builds beautiful, modern software to help businesses elevate the physical workspace experience. With Envoy Visitors, you can greet guests with a welcoming, sleek iPad sign-in app while still protecting your people, property, and ideas. Start your free trial today at envoy.com/twit.
And by LinkedIn Talent Solutions. Find the right people for your business this year at linkedin.com/technews and get $50 off your first job post. Hello and welcome to Tech News Weekly. This is a show where we talk to the people making and breaking the tech news. I'm Megan Maroney.
And I'm Jason Howell. Let's get some VR going.
Yeah,
it's been too long. We've not talked about VR in a while. It's time.
I know. Well, the Oculus Quest, that standalone VR system that I bought my family, arrived last week. It's been pretty much nonstop. I expect you to die and super hot
at our house.
I expect you to die and super hot. Those are VR games, by the way. But it is a new week, and Ars Technica's Sam Moscovich is here using another VR headset, and he's here to talk about it. Welcome back to the show, Sam.
Hey, everybody.
So you have a preview of the Valve Index. It doesn't come out till June 28th, but you've got one in your hands.
Literally in your hand.
I literally have one in my hands. Here's the first thing about it. It's so easy to go in a million directions about VR, but the first cool thing that Valve, and you may know Valve because of Steam VR. They allied with HTC to put out the HTC Vive back in 2016. So you kind of thought of that as the Valve/Steam VR system. Well, HTC has kind of gone in their own direction. They take the Steam VR license and make their own things. And Valve has said, we want to make our own. We have ideas, we have engineers, and we have manufacturing. We're going to make our own stuff. And it began years ago with this thing called the Knuckles. Now, what you may notice is I can let go of this controller.
Don't drop it.
And it doesn't come out because it's cinched around my knuckles. The idea being that in VR, sometimes you might be shooting a gun, pew, pew, pew. Sometimes you might just want to point a finger, and you can pull that out. Sometimes you can want to wave, give a peace sign, other finger gestures. Mm-hmm. They're all supported thanks to 87 sensors in this controller. And they've been working on this for years. Since the end of 2016, they've been showing off prototypes. And we all kind of thought, well, maybe they're just going to put that out as a thing to attach to another system you already own. And then they went one further and they said, oh, yeah, we're putting out an entire new headset, the Valve Index, which looks a lot like other computer virtual reality systems. For example, it's got a big cable on it, meaning it's not wireless. It's not like the Oculus Quest. It requires a computer. It requires wires. It even requires these little tracking boxes that you have to attach in your play space of choice. You can't just put it on like Oculus Quest and go. However, there's a reason that they've gone to all this extra trouble, because it is the most impressive display I have ever used when playing with VR. Now, I strap into a bunch of different headsets, ranging from your giant Oculus launches to sort of your smaller, nichier, weird headsets, some of the Windows mixed reality stuff that is kind of cheaper and full of compromise. The Valve Index uses a high refresh rate panel, meaning it's running at 120 hertz a sec. 120 hertz. So 120 frames of visuals a second beaming into your eyes. And you might think, well, these headsets already kind of run at high speeds. At like 90 frames a second is sort of been the standard. Oculus Quest goes up to 72, which is pretty good. But once you get up to 120, and the other tricks in this, which I go at length about at Ars Technica, especially about sub-pixel density, meaning all of the ways that every little pixel as it's moving around that close to your face, how they all appear clearer and smoother and without a bunch of little crackling in between each of the lights, the result is something I can strap into for hours. I can put this thing on, sit at my desk with a keyboard and mouse, and use VR space as a virtual monitor. There's an app called Virtual Desktop. You can actually use that on Oculus Quest as well. So I've been strapping into that, doing hours of typing, of emailing, mousing around, chatting on Slack with coworkers, watching movies, either my own or through Netflix. And it just doesn't put me in this swimmy sort of thing. Now, I've been testing VR a lot over the years, and I'm used to the thing where I have a thing on my face for, I don't know, 30, 45 minutes, and I get out and my face has that, eyes have this weird swimmy, ugh, and this doesn't do that. I can have this thing on and I'm like, oh, I could play this for hours. And that seems to be the point, because Valve has been teasing 3 virtual reality games that they've been working on. Now, Valve used to make video games. You might remember games like Half-Life and Portal and Left 4 Dead. And Valve hasn't really made games lately, and PC gamers have been wondering what the heck, what's going on, where's Half-Life, etc., etc., etc. One of those games is coming out by the end of the year, and all of the comments I heard from Valve staffers at a preview event a few weeks ago seem to hint at, without actually outright saying, that they want a headset that's good enough. So if you want to play a legit game, meaning your hours-long kind of quest full of story and action, you want to be in the headset for more than 30 minutes without being uncomfortable. So Valve Index seems to be going there and saying, hey, obsessive people who like strapping stuff on their face and connecting it to expensive computers, this is your headset. That's not necessarily the same as Quest, but props to Valve for being pretty clear about that niche and going really hard at it.
Yeah, soon they'll have the Valve Quest, and that'll be the detached system. That's probably a couple of years down the line, though. Who are we kidding?
I could go into that, but go ahead.
Well, the question that I have is about the controllers, because obviously there's a lot that's different here. I personally subscribe to the idea that as these VR headsets, the visible qualities of it get closer and closer to reality, that maybe that might be one of the things that makes them really kind of take over once people, you know, aren't blocked by the idea that they can see the individual pixels and everything. Maybe that pulls them more into this alternate reality. But the controllers here are interesting, except for the fact that, I mean, developers are going to have to work in specifically tailored to this controller functionality within their games. Are they apt to do that, do you think?
Oh, this is a chicken and egg problem, definitely. You'll notice I talked a lot about the headset because it's just very easy to say, if you buy this thing, it's great. You might want to skip that picture, depending on the audience. For those who are not watching, there was one of me testing out the finger capability of the controller. The problem is a pair of these is $280 standalone. That's $20 less than a Nintendo Switch. That's a crazy price to ask for controllers. And in my testing thus far, again, I'm in a preview state. This doesn't come out until June 28th. The headset's $500. The full system with the headset and controllers and sensors is $1,000. And if you just want to get a pair of these standalone to add to whatever else you already own, that's $280. And right now, they're not done. There's a lot of little things that aren't quite working. So sometimes the finger tracking is off. It won't actually get my fingers 100% accurate. And once it gets kind of close, you're in an uncanny valley. Like once you're beyond that abstraction of just trigger on, trigger off, once you've got this sort of dangly possibility, you start to look at it and go, oh, well, that's not 100% perfect, so I don't want to use it. So that's kind of a problem. And then on top of that, what if I want to make a VR game that sells? Like, what if I want to support as many people as possible? Why would I make a game that requires this extra finger tracking or this extra grip panel? There's a little thing that I can just squeeze here. You can't even see it, but it's a force-sensitive grip. The idea being that, like, if you're doing a wall climbing simulator or other sort of strange real-life facsimiles, you can have a grip replication. Okay, that sounds kind of cool and future science-y, but why would I make a game for that if these thing costs a lot of money and not everyone's going to buy it? So I think that's an actual big problem, and Valve essentially needs to get a game out there, like Super Mario 64 back on the N64. You may remember that weird three-pronged N64 controller, and everyone said, what the heck is that? Looks uncomfortable and terrible. But then Mario 64 came out, and everyone lost their minds because it had an analog stick, and you could move a 3D character in a way that did not suck. Mm-hmm. So this could be an equivalent, but we haven't seen any software like that yet. So until that appears, that is a giant question mark for the system.
So the Oculus Quest is super easy to set up, and you know, it doesn't require a big, fast computer. So I kind of know where that one fits in the marketplace. It's for me. But where does this one, where does this new device, where will that fit in the marketplace? It's $1,000. It seems like it's not even compatible with some of the same older Valve stuff. Who will buy this?
This is for, well, it's sold out because they, I don't know how many they've made, but they put out a pre-order listing a couple weeks ago, sold out. If you try to buy one now, they say it might ship in September. We're not sure. So whatever allocation they've got has sold to the target audience of PC hardcore VR gamers, which might be tens of thousands of people, which is, you know, if you can sell out of a limited batch, great. I really think that this is the first gen of something better, as in eventually something wireless, something that doesn't require extra cameras, that has the cameras just built into it, kind of like the Oculus Quest. I think this is them saying, all right, and they've kind of said as much in interviews, we wanted to get one problem tackled, which was fidelity, that sense that you could play something for hours and feel comfortable. We'll get to the other stuff later, meaning lower price and lower friction. They want to reduce the friction. They want to have something that is close to Quest simplicity. They want something close to Quest price, but they've started off with a higher price for people like, you know what, I don't want to wait for this thing to be affordable and easier to use. That's who it's going toward, and it did sell out. So I think they did it right.
Well, Sam, thank you so much for joining us. Sam has a full review of the Valve and...
Not quite a review, though, right? Like, this is like a preview, review length.
It is. It's very long.
Well, people have a lot of questions about... to Ars Technica. It's very long, and we will have more on Index. We already have a giant couple of pieces about Quest. If you're interested in VR, at Sam Red, hit me up. I will answer any decent questions about VR. Nothing like, where's Half-Life? I'm not going to answer that.
Okay. Good to know. Thank you so much for coming on.
Go back to your virtual world there, Sam.
Where am I?
See you later. All right. Thank you, Sam. Always great to get Sam on the show. Up next, Twitter is getting serious about cracking down on extremism. But why now? What's going on? Joseph Cox from Vice will join us to talk about that. But first, this episode of Tech News Weekly is brought to you by Envoy. It's time to welcome guests to the modern lobby and be ready for everything that comes through your front door. Envoy Visitors is an iPad kiosk. I actually have one right here. We have one at the front of our facility here. It makes workplaces more efficient. So here's how Envoy Visitors works. When visitors arrive, they sign in on an iPad kiosk. They just hit that button, enter in some details. Here, I'll go ahead and hit it so you can kind of see just very briefly here. Kind of hard to see here, but you enter in some details, sign legal documents that you might need to sign in order to enter, like NDAs. It all happens right on the iPad. Envoy then notifies their host. Envoy will automatically alert your employee when a guest arrives, so it saves you time, it saves you hassle. Your employee knows who's coming and when, making awkward meetings a thing of the past, thankfully. We've all experienced those. Here are the benefits of using Envoy Visitors. You can boost your office efficiency with smart security that does not intimidate. There's no more paper logbook that doesn't provide any real value. Step into the digital age, finally. Sign in unlimited visitors. You can print customized badges, send alerts when VIPs arrive. It even notifies administrators about unattended guests. And you can integrate your existing security systems like Wi-Fi access, ID checks, and emergency notifications. That's going to give you even more enhanced security. And finally, you'll have data on the visitors in your office so you know who's coming. You know when they're on site and who they're meeting with and why. Envoy Visitors works with the tools you already use. If you're using Slack, G Suite, Box, Salesforce Chatter, just to name a few, they're designed to help companies of all types, including those in highly regulated industries, meet security and compliance requirements specifically. And you can join companies like Nike, Pinterest, and Spotify that have worked with Envoy to welcome over 30 million visitors to their facilities. Protect your people, property, and ideas the welcoming way with Envoy. See why 10,000 workplaces worldwide choose Envoy to make a great first impression. You can go to envoy.com/twit and you'll start your free trial there today. That's envoy.com/twit. And we thank Envoy for their support of Tech News Weekly.
Twitter is doing some research. Specifically, they're toying with the idea that maybe white supremacists don't belong on their platform. Joining us to discuss whether this is too little, too late is Joseph Cox from Motherboard. Welcome back to the show, Joseph.
Hey, thanks for having me again.
So you spoke to a Twitter executive who pondered whether it was better to deplatform extremists or to engage with them. Did it surprise you that Twitter is asking these questions now?
It didn't surprise me too much, but that's because we've been reporting on Twitter's sort of difference when it comes to content moderation. So you'll have Facebook on one side, and they may be very binary. And it'll be stuff like, should we ban them or should we not? Twitter takes a much more multifaceted approach, and it seems they do try to do research before they then implement policies. And of course, Facebook does that as well, but Twitter is just doing it here. So I wouldn't say surprised. The only thing I would say is that it's a little bit late. And at least that's what the academics that we spoke to told us, that this is something that people have been highlighting for years, that this is an issue that Twitter in particular does need to get behind.
And so those academics, so you put to them what the Twitter executive said, that perhaps they pondered that perhaps it would be better to engage with white supremacists on Twitter. And what did the academics specifically say about the potential success of that?
Yeah, so Twitter has this potential idea that they say anecdotally that there's evidence that if you have a voice there to be debated against, so if you leave a white supremacist up or a white nationalist up, you could expose them to good speech, whatever that may be, or counter speech. Some of the academics we spoke to didn't really agree with that, in part because of counter speech itself. Maybe it's not always going to be effective against people who have such a hard-grained ideology, such as white supremacy or white nationalism. But there's also something about Twitter sort of as a platform, as the way it is designed, which is that you may not be able to get context. It's heavily favored towards people who are over the top and very exaggerated. And you may not actually be able to have a good faith argument on Twitter by the very nature of the platform. Now, if you're trying to do good speech or counter speech, you're only going to do that on the premise that the person actually wants to have a proper debate with you and not just be a racist. So, of course, the actual efficacy of that policy is another question that Twitter is going to have to answer as well in its research. Well, and that is what they're trying to do as well.
And so counter speech, from what you're saying, you might not be so effective on Twitter. I mean, is that what exactly? I'm trying to identify what in a social network would need to exist in order for that to be successful, and why Twitter, what Twitter doesn't have, in other words, for it to work in that way.
So, I mean, the executive didn't go into super specifics on what it may actually look like, but we can kind of look at how Twitter and other platforms have dealt with other subjects. So at the moment, there's been a hell of a lot of media coverage about anti-vax. And now if you go on Twitter and you search for sort of anti-vax memes or even keywords, there'll be a pop-up that says, hey, this information has been disproven or something like that, or please follow this link if you want more information. And there's similar on Instagram, I think, or at least they're going to deploy it, and there is similar on Facebook. So from a product point of view, it may look like that. After an investigation we did recently, Facebook banned white nationalism because it came to the conclusion it was the same as white supremacy, at least ideologically. Now, when you go and search for white nationalism content on Facebook, it will have a pop-up like that. So to answer your question, maybe counter speech on Twitter would look something like that, that you search for a white nationalist figure or you engage with a white nationalist tweet, and maybe it would come up with a pop-up with more information. Again, that is me just inferring from what other products there are around dealing with similar issues, but you can imagine something like that. But then even more just philosophically with Twitter, they believe that you can't just hide something and it disappears. They believe that there should be something out there to be debated. And again, that is radically different to other social media platforms who don't try to take that philosophical, open, transparent approach. And they more readily just want to ban offending content.
So you write that it's really not in Twitter's benefit to deplatform these individuals. Can you talk a little bit about that?
I mean, I would frame that as a view from the academics, in that at least some of them said that, you know, it would be very expensive to start banning more users, because of course you need to hire more moderators, you need to invest in tools, that sort of thing. I personally don't 100% buy that argument. In the conversations we had with other Twitter employees as well, the whole financial argument doesn't really seem to make sense. It really is a philosophical, almost cultural approach at Twitter, that does make this different. As for why they may leave them up, I wouldn't say it would be so much deliberate necessarily, but if you look at the moderation of terrorist content, when you have a load of Islamic State accounts or maybe Al-Qaeda accounts, this is going to be a wave of people or accounts that all have the same profile image. For example, there'll be an ISIS flag or something like that. Or when they upload the new Islamic State propaganda, that's very easy to identify because it's largely going to be the same piece of footage. When you're dealing with hate speech, and far-right hate speech is one example of that, it's much more difficult to detect algorithmically at scale. So there is a resource idea there. I'm just not sure if that is the actual reason that Twitter would rather do this, because again, I think that's their culture and that's actually their philosophical approach.
Yeah. Now talk a little bit about how speech restrictions can sometimes catch the wrong actors. I think it was the EFF's Gillian York mentioned this in the piece. How exactly does that happen?
So, I mean, you may have minority communities, just for one example, it could be sex workers, let's say, and they could get caught up into certain filters, or maybe policies that are meant to catch one group could inadvertently be biased against someone else. So, sort of to flip it a little bit, we had an article a while ago, which was sort of that explanation I just gave of the terrorism content. The reason that Twitter doesn't do the same sort of approach for hate speech is because when you have that collateral damage, that may also impact Republicans and Trump supporters. It sounds controversial when you say it, but when you actually think about it, that seems very obvious that there is always going to be collateral when it comes to deploying some sort of content moderation tool. And then again, in the case of hate speech, it's so difficult to fine tune it that that may then impact people who aren't actually the target of that content moderation strategy. And that's going to happen if you try to do it, I don't know, against sexual content, and you're trying to block a load of nudity. You may then end up hitting holiday photos, just for a completely innocuous example. Mm-hmm. But you could have a similar sort of thing for terrorism and then, say, hate speech if you try to do the exact same approach. And this is why social media companies do need to do this research, because every single content moderation strategy is going to be different. Every problem has its own nuances, and you do need a different approach for pretty much everything. And of course, that is where all of this problem comes from in the first place.
Yeah. So let's move on to another story that you posted about Snapchat, or the company Snap. Mm-hmm. You had a scoop about SnapLion, which was a tool, an internal tool that employees were able to use. Talk a little bit about what this tool did and how employees abused it.
Sure. Yeah. So there's sort of two parts to this story. The first being, as you say, this tool called SnapLion. This started as a tool for Snap employees to go and retrieve information in response to valid law enforcement information requests. So if a police officer sends a search warrant or a subpoena or a court order to Snap, which is totally legal and fine, of course, every single tech platform needs to do this to operate in the United States, the Snap employee will go and take the warrant to then use the SnapLion tool to retrieve that information. Now, that might be location information. It could be some of the saved snaps. It won't be the ones that have vanished, but it may be ones that the company has preserved at the order of law enforcement, or ones that the user has saved in their own folder, and then some other information like their email address and phone number. So that's sort of the first part. And then the second part of the story is that we have multiple sources saying that Snap employees had abused their insider data access. Now, the story doesn't specifically say it was SnapLion. We just framed it sort of around that to give an example of one tool. But the allegation is that multiple employees did abuse their access to user data. And this is an issue that we see across the tech industry. It's not just a Snap thing, but this is one example of it happening sort of in the real world.
I mean, I'm not surprised that companies have modes, let's say, that grant all access to all these features, because, you know, at the end of the day, they are responsible for maintaining and managing their platform. So tools like this, you know, arguably need to exist in some degree. It sounds like it's the access to these tools, or the moderating who has access, and actually what is offered within those. Maybe this, you know, maybe SnapLion offers all of these things, you know, photos, password changing, user administration, all this kind of stuff. Maybe there are certain levels of access that this one person actually needs, but doesn't need the whole keys to the kingdom. Could that be a possible solution for something like this?
Yeah, I mean, as you say, these are tools that are kind of necessary, that may be for the security staff, it could be for customer support, whoever. They do have access to this data and they do have legitimate reasons to need to get to it. As for sort of the accessing, yes, the way that they'll deal with it is either they will, you know, record a minimal amount of data in the first place. You cannot abuse the data that you don't collect, right. So they can minimize that. But then it's, of course, also, as you say, the siloing of this data, only allowing certain people to access it. And from what we understand, when this abuse took place, there were fewer restrictions on the SnapLion tool. There was less auditing in place, so it was easier for somebody to go and use that tool without necessarily being caught. Since the abuse, which again, I'm not specifically saying it was SnapLion, that's just the implication. Since that abuse happened, there are more stringent restrictions on this data access. So yeah, it's exactly as you say, that they need to have this data, but they can control who has access to it. And that's the important thing here. Mm-hmm.
Now, from your reporting, was it clear whether some of these photos were photos that people took on Snap expecting them to, or on Snapchat expecting them to have disappeared? Are they hanging around even though we can't see them anymore?
So it's unclear what the specific abuse was, unfortunately. This is the sort of information that is tightly held within these companies. The sort of only people that would know about this are the ones who would need to. So that would be the person dealing with firing of employee, the one researching the abuse. This is going to be very tightly held information. So unfortunately, we don't know exactly what the sort of abuse is. I mean, more generally in the tech industry, we reported, I think last year, that Facebook has fired multiple people for abusing their data access specifically to stalk people. So in the same sort of way that, you know, a domestic violence case or a murder is going to be from a murder of a woman specifically is going to be someone they know, it seems that there is a similar sort of thing when it comes to insider data access. When we covered it on Facebook, it was people stalking their ex-girlfriends, their current girlfriends, that sort of thing. The exact sort of unfortunate misogynist behavior you would expect, but with someone who has access to very sensitive data. So I wouldn't be surprised if that sort of more general approach is across the industry as well.
Well, I guess the good news is as you report on it, they change it. So thank you. Joseph Cox is a reporter and a writer at Vice. He's also Joseph F. Cox on Twitter. Thanks so much for coming on.
Thank you, Joseph.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Take care. Who's spying on you while you're sleeping this week? Jeffrey Fowler from the Washington Post explains after the break. But first, this episode of Tech News Weekly is brought to you by LinkedIn Talent Solutions. Hiring isn't as easy as putting an ad in the paper or posting on a job board. With more qualified candidates than ever, you need something that helps you find the right people for your business. And LinkedIn Jobs does that. With more than 500 million active members, people come to LinkedIn every day to make connections, grow their careers, and discover new job opportunities. 90% of LinkedIn users are open to new opportunities, but not actively scanning all those job boards. This means LinkedIn Jobs gives you access to an entirely different demographic than anywhere else. LinkedIn Jobs uses knowledge of both hard and soft skills to match you with the people who fit your role the best. Things like collaboration or work ethic and adaptability, those are all taken into consideration so LinkedIn Jobs can help you find someone that's not only qualified but also matches with your company's culture. LinkedIn Jobs gets your job in front of the most relevant, qualified candidates so you can focus on making a hire who you're excited about. You're probably already on LinkedIn. It's a platform you're comfortable with, and that's why I think it's the best place to find the people that you want to hire. Everything you need is right there for you. You don't have to learn a new system. Post a job today at linkedin.com/technews, and you'll get $50 off your first job post. That's linkedin.com/technews to get $50 off your first job post. LinkedIn.com/technews. Terms and conditions apply.
So Apple has long been devoted to being the privacy-minded tech company, and they've said as much in their advertising that stresses how user data stays on the iPhone. But that isn't the case in everyday use necessarily. Jeffrey Fowler from the Washington Post wrote about his exploration of what happens on his iPhone while he's asleep. And, well, let's just say it's a lot of stuff happening. Welcome back, Jeffrey.
Hi, glad to be here.
It's good to have you, Jeff. So begin by talking about what kind of secret life your iPhone has been living while you've been asleep.
Yeah, it turns out that it stays really busy talking to lots of companies, including many with names I've never really heard of before, sending them, in some cases, very personal information about me, my exact location, my email address, my phone number, you know, other ways to fingerprint my phone. And it's doing that because all the apps that I've got on my phone seem to be filled with tracker technology. Apple doesn't seem to be putting much of a stop to that in the apps that make it to the App Store.
So how exactly did you track all of this activity? I mean, I imagine this is the kind of thing that if you've discovered it and it's happening with the sheer volume that you talk about in your piece, that it's probably been happening on many iPhones and for a very long time. This is just kind of how the app ecosystem works. So it's surprising that someone hasn't, you know, spent the time to detect it and track it. So what are you using to track all of this activity?
Yeah, I mean, I agree. It's surprising. I'm just a tech journalist. I'm not even a developer or a coder, but I did have a little bit of help. Patrick Jackson, who is the CTO of the privacy tech company Disconnect, he used to work at the NSA. I gave him a ring and I said, hey, can we figure out what's going on my phone while I sleep? And so we use two different kinds of technology to do that. One is a piece of software made by Disconnect called Privacy Pro. It's actually something you can download and try, and there's a free version that you don't have to pay for. If you're interested in doing a version of this experiment, identifies trackers that are coming out of the entire phone, not just your web browser, so including the apps. And then it also tries to block some of them. But then to kind of get an even deeper view of what was going on my phone and figure out which apps specifically were sending out data to which trackers and also what kind of data they were sending, I used a program called the Charles Proxy, which is often used to do diagnostics on apps. You know, it kept all night long while I was sleeping. It kept a log of everything that went in and out of my phone. Some of it was encrypted, but not all of it. And digging through those records, we found, you know, a good dozen trackers even while I was sleeping. And the phone screen was turned off. I was snoring. The phone was dark. We found them sending out, you know, again, all kinds of personal data to tracking companies that I had never heard of and certainly hadn't intentionally installed on my phone.
So I downloaded the Privacy Pro app. It's free to use for a week, I think. And I got all the same ones that you did. And it was shocking. It was like right away. You know, it was just like
they
everything.
You just assume at this point that well, of course you do.
Yeah. Do you recommend that people subscribe to this app? Is it worth paying for? Like, I'm not exactly sure what this information, how this information would be helpful to me on a long-term basis.
Sure. So a couple of things. One, Privacy Pro is actually free, not just for a week, it's entirely free. When you install the app, it does come up with a message that asks you if you want to subscribe to their VPN service, which they do charge for. But you can just X out of that, and you still get all the benefits of identifying the trackers on your phone and also blocking some of them. As for whether you want to keep it on there in the long term, think of Privacy Pro kind of like Disconnect or Privacy Badger or Ghostery for a web browser. And so if you're the kind of person who installs one of those in Chrome or whatever other web browser you use, or you choose Firefox as your web browser, then you might want to consider this for your phone. After this experiment, I certainly intend to keep Privacy Pro running on my phone because I don't want trackers, you know, first of all, collecting my personal information, but also eating up my data. I mean, one of the most shocking things about this was in the span of a week, so during the day and the night, Privacy Pro found 4,500 trackers on my phone, which is an appalling number. And if you multiplied that out over an entire month, that would have taken up 1.5 gigabytes of data. That is half of a monthly basic plan from AT&T, all just going to tracker activity that doesn't need to be happening and we don't really necessarily want. Lord only knows what kind of impact that has on my battery life too.
Yeah. And some of this is, I mean, it really is, you know, it's easy to talk about this and go into the direction of everything's nefarious, you know, all of this stuff is nefarious. Some of it's just straight up like app analytics, right? Like developers have long built in app analytics to understand, you know, what features of their apps are working for users, and they might transfer that information back so that they know how to tweak their apps. But I guess there, you know, it comes down to the sheer volume. When you're talking about the volume, I mean, it's impossible as a user to know what is even, you know, quote, legitimate and what might not be, or even what happens to that data beyond.
Sure. You bring up a couple of good questions and good points. First of all, if we don't know where our data is going, how can we possibly hope to stay on top of our privacy or to stay private? We can't. And the way that the iPhone is designed right now, we can't know what apps are really doing. Even if you go to their privacy policies and read them, they keep it vague. They don't really tell you what companies they're working with. And I found, at least in one case, they were just lying about what they did with third parties. But you're right. Trackers do lots of things. Some are for analytics to see how people are using the app. Others are for marketing, or others might be collecting your data to sell on to data brokers. It is hard to tell. I use the definition of a tracker that came from Disconnect. These people are very smart, and they spend all day long thinking about privacy. And their definition of a tracker, of an unwanted tracker, is a company that – a third party that collects our data and stores it, and then also doesn't have consumer-friendly privacy policies. That includes things like anonymizing data and also giving an end date to delete it. Because even if a company is, you know, just in the business of trying to help apps run better, we know that there's a problem that can happen if they get breached, right? And so holding onto our data for a while could lead to a problem. Or, as we've seen many times, companies that start in one kind of business end up shifting to a different kind of one by the time their funding runs out and they need to pivot, and all of a sudden they realize that our data is one of the most valuable things that they have. So my general rule as a person who cares about privacy in this world is we should be collecting less of it with fewer people, more data, more problems.
So you say that even the Washington Post, your employer, was they were collecting, tracking you in the middle of the night. Do you know what information they were sending out of you?
Yeah, they were using some marketing trackers as well as some analytics trackers. The Post said that those trackers were helping it make sure that the apps were displaying correctly. I heard that kind of response from a lot of people. I mean, I think a really typical one that's probably maybe a good example for us to talk about is DoorDash. They are the, you know, the food delivery service. In the DoorDash app, you open it and you think you're having a conversation just with DoorDash. That's what you installed on your phone, right? But it turns out you open it, it's talking to 9 different trackers at the same time. So I asked DoorDash to explain what all those trackers were to me. Some are there to help it figure out if there is fraud going on your phone. And those people get a lot of information about your phone. Again, open question of like how long they keep it, whether they anonymize it eventually, do they delete it, that kind of stuff. Then there's a set that are for analytics. DoorDash says it helps them make sure the app is running correctly. They get even more data, more personal data, ways to identify your phone. Again, same questions. How long do they hold on to that? When do they delete it? How do they protect it? And then finally, there's the largest category is marketing trackers. So every time you open DoorDash, you're sending a signal off to Facebook and Google both to let them know that you've opened DoorDash. Is that what you thought you were doing when you were launching that app? I didn't.
Yeah, we don't really know what we're doing when we launch an app. We're just like, I want some food. That's why I'm here.
Exactly. And that's exactly the trap that these companies have got us all in, right? Yeah. We want the convenience and the capabilities here, and they've made us sort of accept that giving up our privacy is a cost of it. And I think that is a false choice, and we need to fight back.
Yeah. So how can Apple do better here? Because this, I mean, you know, I'm used to hearing these or, you know, reading articles similar to this or hearing about this stuff. You know, I'm an Android guy, so I'm very used to hearing about this stuff around Android. So Apple, a little less so. Apple's kind of built its business around being at least, you know, publicly perceived as the kind of more privacy conscious company. What can they do better here?
Yeah, Apple is the company that took out that big ad at CES this year that said, what happens on your iPhone stays on your iPhone.
Right.
Clearly, my experiment shows that that is not the case. I think we have to remember that Apple, first of all, has raised that bar and has set that for themselves, so we need to hold them to it. And then second of all, that they have complete control over the way iOS works as well as the way the App Store works. So last year, they made a pretty big deal about some changes that they made to the Safari web browser to make it harder to track us. So they've said that they care about this issue. They care about trackers and they want to stop the data broker economy, and they've taken steps to deal with it in the browser. So then why not the entire phone? One way they could do that is just by better policing the App Store, by doing essentially my experiment and watching who's sending out data and really checking, A, are they keeping up with their own privacy policies? Do their privacy policies really make it clear that which third parties they're sending data out to? Or I think the best idea of all is they should just have to disclose it to us, just like websites do after GDPR, open a website and it says, yeah, we're using cookies. Are you okay with that? Well, let's imagine you open DoorDash in the future on iOS 13 or iOS 14 and might have to say, hey, we've got 9 trackers running. Are you cool with that? Now, some people might say, I'm not cool with that, and choose something else. Or it might force apps to really think about whether they really need to be collecting all this data with third parties. And maybe we can develop better and healthier practices as an industry.
Absolutely. Jeffrey Fowler, always great to get you on. Thank you so much for carving out a few minutes for us today. WashingtonPost.com. Check out Jeff's article there and all of the awesome work that you do. Thank you, Jeff. Appreciate it.
You bet.
We'll talk to you soon.
Writing in Medium's tech publication 10, author Susie Cagle says that bars all over the U.S. and Canada are using a service called Patron Scan to verify IDs and collect basic customer demographic data. Now, in addition to helping keep out underage drinkers, Patron Scan also allows the bars to keep a record of people who have been kicked out of other bars that use Patron Scan. So it's basically like a no-fly list, but for booze. Like all of the new uses of ID scanning technology, the system has its benefits, but privacy experts are starting to wonder if Patron Scan could be used to target people they don't want in their bars for other reasons besides just bad bar behavior. What do you think? Should bars be collecting our ID information to later use against us?
Oh, boy. So obviously technology, you know, data, all this stuff enables us to eliminate risk. And that's what this is all about. It's all about risk reduction, right? If you're a bar owner, you want to make sure that your facility is safe. And that's always been the case, you know, that anyone who owns a business, they want to make sure that their employees and their patrons are safe and everything. So they'll do whatever they can. Data bring and connect, you know, always on connection to the internet and all this data sharing brings another level to it to where it's not just, I had a bad experience with this person can no longer come to our bar and it's up to us to police it. It's now, I had a bad experience with this person and now everybody is going to make sure that you never go to a bar again. End of story. And I just, I don't know, like, I feel like it's, you know, this is one example of that. People can say the wrong thing on social media and there are obviously incidents where people absolutely have ill intentions, but people could say the wrong thing and not intend it, but still have it be flagged and boom, they're off or the mob is focused on them now. And that's just their existence online. Mm-hmm. So I don't know, like the more I think about like this data sharing in order to police things and completely eliminate risk, I'm like, well, but then people don't have the chance to be human and rise above it. And redo.
Mm-hmm. Get in a bar fight and then,
You know what? Bar fights happen. And sometimes they happen and the person comes out of it. You know, sometimes people are douches and they're like, yeah, I'm going to go to another bar and get into a fight. Sometimes people are human and they learn their lesson and they realize, like, I don't want to do that again.
Yeah.
And if they're completely kicked out for the rest of their lives from this whole network of bars, and I'm only using bars as an example, it's kind of silly because, I mean, a bar is a bar, whatever. It's not an essential human need. But I don't know. I just think it's a slippery slope as we get further and further in this data economy.
I mean, there's two problems with Patron Scan that I learned from this article. One is that they don't really tell people that they're entering them into this database. It's sort of just like, here's your ID. We're going to scan it through here. All right, go on in.
Right.
They don't say like, and by the way, like your demographic information will be saved here for, you know, an unlimited amount of time and then maybe used against you later. The other problem is that they have like certain definitions, like, you know, if you're accused of sexual assault or, you know, fighting or stealing and then there's other. So there's just this like
other category
where it's just like, I just don't like you. I just don't like what you look like, you know, whatever you used to date my girlfriend and, you know, whatever it is. And then so it's that other that is suspicious. So I think, we're just seeing so much stuff like this all the time everywhere.
Well, and we were talking about it a little bit earlier with the Snapchat tool, like who has the keys, who makes the decision? It really could just be some random person that decides, you know, like, oh, well, I just really don't like that person. So, boom, that person's not allowed in any of these other places, not allowed to just be a human being, you know, which is not to say that there aren't people that make really poor decisions and probably should not be going to bars. Mm. But I just think that it's becoming easier and easier to use one person's mistake. Like, Like if I could go back in time, I've never gotten into a bar fight, but if I could go back in time, I'm sure I've made a complete ass of myself at a bar. Who knows, you know, if I would have been added onto this list. I'd like to think that I probably wouldn't end up on that list, but I was given the ability to make an ass of myself and still come out the other end and learn and be a better person as a result of it. And something like this just like automatically pegs that person as, nope, you are bad. No more. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, that's something rings wrong for me on that.
Right. This does also like remind me of the same thing I say all the time, like, you know, there, but for the grace of God that YouTube did not exist when I was in college.
Exactly. Oh, totally. Totally.
So.
Absolutely. All right. We've got some weighty topics on this week's show. Artificial intelligence is an oft-used buzzword. It seems to imply that much of what's happening was created by the intelligence of something, well, artificial. Humans are not artificial, most of them anyways. In the case of Google's assistant, it sounds like it's largely made up of the work of human temp workers who produce the linguistic data sets that assistant relies on. Those temp workers are part of a larger pool of temp workers across the company that actually outnumbers full-time staff, according to the New York Times. This lets Google off the hook in offering those employees, or those workers, they're not employees, any number of perks, benefits, in some cases, access to information that would actually keep them safe while they're at work. Because contractors working for the company, you know, they're barred from a number of things. They're not full time employees, so they don't, you know, they aren't holiday parties, all hands meetings, can't see internal job posts, which I find interesting. Like, don't you want the people that are temping for you who already know your systems to be able to apply for jobs or attend to Google job fairs? And then not only that, like from a security standpoint, like as one example, the YouTube shooting that happened, there was an email blast that went out to all employees that did not go out to temp workers. And so in some cases that could have, you know, that could have resulted in actual harm or worse. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. And this is not isolated to Google either. A lot of the big tech companies do this.
No, I mean, I worked for Microsoft for 11 years, and I say I worked for Microsoft, but I actually worked for an agency to work for Microsoft. So I was what was called a vendor, which is such a weird word for a person, but I was a vendor, which means I was essentially a full-time employee with no benefits. I didn't get invited to holiday parties, and I was allowed to live in Petaluma as opposed to living in, you know, Seattle, Washington, which was my choice. Like they were often like, you know, there's this job posting, you'd be great for it, you'd have to move to Seattle. No, thank you. So it was, you know, it was great, but I got paid well, but I did not get paid nearly as much as what Microsoft was paying to have me work there, because they had to pay this agency where I had benefits and they were good. And, you know, I had insurance and all of that. But I mean, I didn't really know exactly how much Microsoft was paying. And once I just got an email that I wasn't supposed to get, and I was like, oh my goodness, like my agency is taking that much money per hour that I'm working there. And then I probably would have still been working there. But when Satya Nadella became CEO, that was part of what he did. He cleared he basically said, why are these people, she's been working here for 11 years. She has full access to our network, like she, you know, full security, like can get anywhere. And yet she's not a full-time employee. And then they were like, you can't, you know, you got to work here, or, you know, you got to move here and work here,
or you
can't. Yeah. And I was out, and that, you know, and then I came back here, which was great. So, but I do think that maybe Microsoft is a little further ahead, because they were the ones that got burned, you know, in the 90s, because they had a bunch of temp workers who didn't get stock options and then missed. And they were basically, they were in the office. They were basically full-time employees, but they just called them temps because, you know, they just didn't know how long they were going to need them. And they missed out on, you know, millions of dollars when the company went public. So so I don't know. It is interesting. And especially when they're doing, like the work I was doing was, you know, easy work. This is, you know, some of these people are like having to look at the, you know, videos, go through them you know, look at violent videos. And I mean that, they shouldn't have to, you know, work overtime. Like it describes them as having a lot of unpaid overtime.
Yeah, exactly. And there being the carrot being dangled in front of them being that, you know, if you put in a lot of work right now, you might potentially be converted, even though they told them outright when they were hired, there is 100% absolutely no way you will ever convert to a full-time job here, yet then dangling that carrot, mm-hmm. getting them to work overtime, and who knows what's lost in translation as far as that's concerned. But I mean, companies like Google can save, you know, talk about saving money by hiring temp versus full-time. They could save up to like around $100,000 per year per contractor compared to a full-time employee. So there's and when you consider in Google's case that more than full-time employee, you know, there are more contract workers than full-time employees, just like there's a reason for that. There is a reason for that, and it's probably money.
Right.
And, you know, I mean, the, you know, the, those employees, I mean, maybe that's just kind of part of the temp working thing. I worked as a temp worker years and years ago, and I didn't think it was unjust, you know, that, that I was being abused or anything, you know, for my time or anything like that. But when you look at it from a systemic perspective at Google's hiring practices and you see how outweighed it is, then it begins to kind of seem a little fishy, kind of seem like, all right, you guys know what you're doing here. You know that you're getting by without having to do all of this other stuff in order to hire, you know, from a temp perspective. And maybe that isn't right. Like, maybe that needs to be reevaluated.
Well, and like so many of the stories that we're seeing in the tech world, like there is more of a organizing going on, like worker organizing, like a little bit of a labor movement. And because the unemployment rate is so low. And so it really is time where people can say like, hey, you know, I could get a job that's not making me work overtime and not get paid. Like I, you know, and so it's great that they have a voice. You know, I want them to have more of a voice.
Absolutely. Well, that was cheery. Tech News Week. There were so many like really heavy stories this week. Tech News Weekly records live every Thursday at 11 a.m. Pacific. If you want more cheery talk, we'll be back next week. twit.tv/live. If you want to catch it live, you can be part of the show as well by emailing us at tnw@twit.tv.
And subscribe to our show. Go to twit.tv/tnw. You can subscribe. Choose your way. Watch however you watch podcasts or however you listen. We have all the options there. And follow us on social media. You can find Twit on Twitter. You can find us on Instagram. You can find Inside Twit in both places as well. And you can find me on Twitter. I'm at Megan Maroney.
And I'm at Jason Howell. Thanks to everyone who helps us do this show. Burke, of course, for Scrolling Words. Jammer B is here. Jeff Brockman, new engineer. And that's about it. Just kidding, Alex. All right, that's it for this week. We'll see you next week on another episode of Tech News Weekly. Bye, everybody.